Our parsha is Vayetze. We'll quickly run through the parsha and then try to review it with more depth. Yaakov leaves Beersheva. Interesting why he was there. Goes to Haran. Remember the deal. He's going to find a wife. He comes to this extraordinary place, goes to sleep. He has a dream. He sees a ladder, angels going up, angels going down. God's there, and God tells him, I am Hashem, the God of Abraham and Isaac, and I'm giving you this land. Your children will flourish, and the nations of the world will bless themselves in you. I will be with you, I will protect you, I'll bring you back. And Yaakov wakes up and says, wow, what a holy place. I didn't realize that. So he says, this is the house of God, this is the gates to heaven. He takes the stone that was by his head, he places it as a matzeva, a one-stone altar, and pours oil, libates oil over it, names the place Beit El, house of God, and takes a vow. God should be with me, and let's finish and then come back. God should be with me and protect me and give me food to eat and clothing to wear. I should return in peace to my father's house, and Hashem will be the force that constantly looks out for me, and then I will keep my end of the deal. I will take this stone and make it into a house of worship for Hashem, and whatever God gives me, I will tithe and maybe even tithe twice. And then he goes out, he sees a well, he sees three flocks of sheep, and there's a large stone. So he asks them, guys, where are you from? They say, we're from Haran. He says, do you know Lavan? They say, sure. He says, do you know if everything's okay by him? They say, yeah. And there's Rachel, his daughter, coming with the sheep. He says, hey, you know, it's pretty early in the day. Why you guys, it's not time to go home. Why don't you just give the cattle to drink and go continue grazing? So they say, yeah, it's going to take a while till enough shepherds gather here, and then we can take off the stone. We can't give the sheep to drink till all the shepherds come, and then we take off the stone, and we give the sheep to drink, and then we can go. So Rachel shows up, and Yaakov walks over and takes the stone off the well, and he gives the sheep to drink. And he tells her that he's her uncle. He is in his 70s, and she is a little girl. He kisses her and cries, and she runs home. Lavan hears that his cousin's in town. He runs out. He hugs him. He kisses him, brings him home. Lavan is looking, where's all your money, man? You know, you come from a wealthy family. So Yaakov tells him the whole story, what's happened between him and Esav. And Lavan says, okay, stick around. Yaakov takes care of the sheep. And after a month, Lavan tells him, I know you don't want to work here for free, so what's the deal? So Lavan has two daughters, twins, Leah and Rachel. And Yaakov says, I'll work for 7 years on behalf of Rachel, your small daughter. Lavan says, better you than anyone else. Stick around. So Yaakov's working for 7 years. And then the time comes. Lavan makes a party. He wants to get Yaakov good and drunk. Notice that the second time he makes a wedding, he doesn't make a party. So this time he brings a lot of booze. And he gives Yaakov a lot to drink. And then he takes Rachel and brings her to a palace and locks her up there. And takes Leah and brings her. And the next, all night long, Yaakov's with Leah. He thinks it's Rachel. The next morning, he runs to Lavan and says, what'd you do? We agreed on Rachel. Lavan says, nah, I can't marry the young one for the old one. Doesn't work that way. Finish off the week with Leah, and then we'll give you the other one. Okay, you'll work another 7 years. And we know the story. Leah is hated, and so God gives her a child, Reuven, and then Shimon, and then Levi, etc. We're going to skip to the end of the story. At the end of the 14 years, Yaakov says, I gotta go. Lavan says, no, things have been good with you around. Tell me what wages you want, and then we'll stick around. So Yaakov says, fine, you've become very wealthy thanks to my hard work. So here's the deal. I'll watch the sheep. You take out all the sheep that aren't perfectly white. And then whatever sheep that are born that aren't perfectly white, they're going to be mine. So Lavan says, great idea. He takes out all the sheep that are spotted, etc. and puts him in a corral 3 days' journey away. And Yaakov continues taking care of the sheep, and he figures out tricks to ensure that the sheep give birth to sheep that will end up being his. And Yaakov sees that Laban and his kids are very upset with him that he's become so wealthy. He calls his wives. God has told him to go back to Canaan. He tells them they're with him. When Laban is far away, shearing the sheep, they run away. Laban catches up. Rachel has stolen the idol, the trophim, when they have left, trying to get her father to stop worshiping idols. Laban is coming fully armed, and God appears to Laban in a dream and says, you better not touch Yaakov. And so Laban shows up and says, what'd you do? You left. You didn't tell me. You took my daughters like captives. And I understand maybe you were really, you missed your parents after so many years, but what'd you take my God for? Yaakov says, we're not allowed to steal. No hide that steal gets a death penalty. If anyone's caught stealing or taking a god, an idol, so they'll get the death penalty. But show me if I have anything that's not yours, that's not mine. So Laban goes searching their tents, and Rachel sits on the trophim, and she says, you know, I'm not feeling well, Dad. You know, it's that time of the month. Can't get up. So he searches the whole tent, and obviously he doesn't find, and Yaakov picks a fight with him. He says, what did I do? Look at how you ran after me, armed to the tooth. You looked through all my things. Did you find a spoon that was yours? Did I take anything that wasn't mine? After all these years, 20 years I'm in your house, and you kept swindling me, and look how God's taken care of me, as hard as I've worked. And Levin says, what do you want? Everything here is mine. What do you mean nothing here is mine? The kids are mine, the daughters are mine, the grandchildren are mine. Everything you have here, you made off of me. So be very happy, but let's make a pact. I won't harm you, you won't harm me. They take a pile of stones, they eat on the pile of stones, they put in a knife in there. Levin gets up in the morning, kisses everyone goodbye, and goes. Yaakov continues his route to Israel, and angels come to meet him. And Yaakov names the place Machanayim, where the two camps meet, his camp and the camp of God. So let's go back over our parsha. Our parsha begins with angels and ends with angels. Yaakov is leaving Israel. Terrible thing, he's leaving Israel. We find in life sometimes people have to leave, but they have to know it's not a simple thing. And we have, just as we have different times in the year and in the month and in the week, where there are different levels of Ashgacha. On Shabbos, we have special angels that come to accompany us. But the same token, there are different places that have different levels of Ashgacha. You're in the land of Israel. You have special angels. Even Yaakov, that's leaving Israel, he sees a funny dream. Angels going up and coming down. Don't angels belong in heaven? Shouldn't they come down first and then go up? No. There were the angels who were accompanying him in Israel. Those angels he doesn't get to have in Chutzarts. When he's going to Chutzarts, the angels who were accompanying him, they go up the ladder and other angels come down. So he's traveling, and he doesn't realize he's passing the Temple Mount, the place where his own father was bound, the place where first man was created. And so God makes the sunset early, and he prays the evening prayer. Notice he prays Ma'ariv just by sunset, just like the Sfaradim do, the ancient custom of davening Ma'ariv real early. You just got to repeat Kriyat Shema again. And he goes to sleep, and you see that this is the first time he's going to sleep after 14 years learning Torah, and he never put his head down on a pillow. He'd always just fall asleep and then keep working. So he was a really hard worker. And he's going to sleep, and his dreams are lofty dreams. He dreams of a sulam. The sulam is the ladder. The ladder is Sinai. It's the capacity to grow. God is telling him, I will give you the capacity to grow in spirituality. Sulam has the numeric value of Sinai. God is telling him there will be angels going up the ladder. That's a reference to the idea that God will give us a Torah, that God will give us a capacity to grow up to the heavens. God is telling him, you should know there are also angels going down the ladder. There's an up and down. There's Moshe going up Sinai. There's Moshe coming down from Sinai with the Torah for the people. And our sages tell us that the angels going up and down were angels who were ready to kill Yaakov. Because they went up to heaven, and in heaven there was a vision of Yaakov. There was this figure of Yaakov's great potential. And the angels are going up, and they see the figure, and they come down, and they compare it to the sleeping body, and they say, what's he sleeping for? He hasn't finished his work. We want to kill him. Hashem nitzav alav. Hashem is on Yaakov protecting him. So Hashem says no. But there's this concept where we all have a potential that's up there. There's a representation of our potential in heaven. And when we're going to get there, they're not going to ask us, why didn't you live up to someone else's potential? But they will ask us, did we live up to our own potential? And that's a scary thing. So God blesses Yaakov. He says, you know, I'm going to be with you, and I'll protect you, and I'll bring you back here. You know, I remember when I first came to Israel, so this goes back to almost two decades ago. Back then, it was fairly cheap to buy a two-way ticket where the return ticket was open. So I'd come to Israel, and I'd always have a return ticket to the U.S. with an open date. And I remember waiting for the day that I'd come to Israel without a return ticket. That whenever I'd go to Chutzarts, I'd have a return ticket to Israel. Where Baruch Hashem today, that's the way it is, right? So God's telling Yaakov, I'll bring you back. If you look, you'll see there are many people who left Israel with the thought, I'm coming back. And many do not. Chutzarts has a way of enveloping us. Suddenly, you can make a living here. How are you going to make a living there? Suddenly, you have a wife and family, and it's very easy to get enamored. Chutzarts has its blessings. And Yaakov's getting a beautiful blessing before he leaves. I'm with you, and I'll help you come back. That's one of the great challenges. I can tell you every time I walk off the plane, I'm always saying psalms. I'm saying Tehillim, Hashem, help me get back. It's never a given for me. I never take it for granted. So Hashem tells him, I'll protect you. I won't leave you. And Yaakov awakens. Now, this is a unique prophecy. The Rambam writes in his introduction to Mishnah that when a prophet is given a prophecy that he's to tell over to others, there we have a guarantee that a prophecy that's a good prophecy, a prophecy that says positive information, is never rescinded. God will always maintain that prophecy. Whereas a prophecy about bad things, like the destruction of Nineveh, that's a prophecy where God might change the prophecy. If a person changes his ways, then God says it might change. So Maimonides says, how can you ever tell if a prophet is telling the truth if it's a prophecy for good? But what about a personal prophecy? Yaakov is being told what the future holds, but he's not told to tell it to anyone. So even though God promises him good things, in such an instance, there's no guarantee that God won't turn back on the prophecy. God says, there's a condition. Every prophecy has a certain stipulation. God says, I will give you good things. That's with the assumption that you live up to your end of the deal. What would happen if Yaakov would go out to Aram and then he'd become a gangster? God promised me. He's taking care of me. Why not? So then God says that wasn't the understanding. I'm telling you, you stick to your end of the deal, and this is what I'll offer you. You just maintain your end of the deal. So that's a stipulation that's built into many prophecies where God says something good will happen, but it's self-understood that you have to live up to your end of the deal. So that's why in next week's parsha, Yaakov is going to be concerned that maybe things will go bad, because even though God gave him a prophecy that things will be good, that's not a guarantee, given that it was a personal prophecy. So you no longer have that guarantee that a prophecy for good won't change. Yaakov awakens and says, gee, I didn't realize what a holy place. I went to sleep here. And he says, Ein ze ki im beis Elokim. This is the house of God. Yaakov was the first one to use the term bayis, house. We call it Beit HaMikdash. Yaakov's terminology, bayit. And that's something to think about. The temple is called bayit. You guys wanted a class on the Jewish bayit. There's a correlation here. So Yaakov, you know, Avraham Avinu saw it as a mountain. Yitzhak Avinu saw it as a field. He's going out to talk in the field. Yaakov, it's his home. And that's where every person has to aspire to. I remember as a youngster, I offered the shul where I grew up, I offered them to help revamp the Beis Medrash they had. So I met with the Gabbai, and I volunteered my time. And then I said to him, you know, we have plenty of books in the library that belong in the Beis Medrash. So he said, they're not allowed to move. I said, why? You know, people are learning in the Beis Medrash. Let's make it available for them. He said, nope. There are many people in this congregation that feel very comfortable walking into a library, but they will not feel comfortable walking into a Beis Medrash. So if we leave the books in the library, those people will feel comfortable accessing them. The second you put them in a base medrash, that's scary to them. Even the temple is supposed to be a bayit. Yeah, King David said, I aspire to be there every morning and every night. He says, Achat sha'alti me'et Hashem, shivti b'veit Hashem kol yamei chayai. So, guys, that's your job. When I visit you in your shuls, I want to see you sitting up front. You should be the gabbai, you should be the president. If you're not the rabbi, if you're the rabbi, good. But if you're not, why are you laughing? Every one of you has tremendous leadership qualities. No one makes it to Machon Meir unless they were able to stand up to a whole world that told them they're crazy. Okay? Every one of you has your world, your group of people that say, come on, what's wrong with you? And now, if you made it here, that means you have those qualities where you can stand up and lead, and you don't wait to be led. Okay, so the question is where you'll take those qualities. Coming back, and you should know we have plenty of alumni who are rabbis. It's true, when they came here, they didn't know Aleph Beis, but Rabbi Akiva also didn't know Aleph Beis. It's a question of stamina. It's a question of how much is a person willing to put in to make it happen. But it can happen. I'd say well over 30%, it's probably over 50% of the rabbis here at the Machon started out as students here. You'll see, come Purim time, they put up a chart with everyone's dark history. Part of Adar is they have this chart where they put pictures of all the different rabbis, and you have to see how you could recognize them. So you see one as a rock star artist, and another one on his motorcycle, and everyone's up there. You got these old pictures where you see each one where they came from. Now, these are the rabbis of Machon Meir. You know, we have rabbis here. We have a rabbi who was a Hollywood actor. You guys probably know. We have a rabbi here who was a top actor in Israeli film. Everyone, I mean, from Rav Bigon onward. You guys know Rav Bigon didn't know anything when he started out. He was in the army. He started reading Tanakh. He tells the story. It's not a hidden story. He grew up on a kibbutz together with Ehud Barak. He grew up where? What? Ehud Barak?
Really been hiding yeshiva.
He was prime minister.
But I don't know much about Israeli politics.
Fine. He was prime minister before Netanyahu. He was, and he was the one who wanted to give away at least half of Jerusalem. And they're good friends, Rav Bigon and Ehud Barak still. Yes. They grew up together. They served in the army together. Yeah.
Barak's quite a bit younger, though, isn't he?
I'm thinking so, no. He looks younger, right? Coming back to our parsha. So, Yaakov takes the stone. We have a tradition that the stone was a bunch of small stones. And you guys know the Rashi on this, right? Every stone said, the tzaddik will put his head on me. Yeah. The Medrash says that in awe of Hashem, the stones unified and became one. And he pours oil. Where did he get oil from? So there's a beautiful Medrash that says there's a flask of oil that stays with us throughout Jewish history. It began wherever to be discussed, but here it shows up with Yaakov Avinu. And that's the flask of oil that shows up on Hanukkah. It shows up in other places. Maybe we'll discuss it on Thursday night. So that's a medrash that says there's this flask that shows up in pivotal places in Jewish history. You have to know there are certain things that show up in pivotal places. There are certain things that just keep showing up, like the ram of Avram Avinu. It's different components, right? It's horns. One is going to be the horn of Mashiach. It's the Miriam's tambourine was made from the hide. King David's harp was made from the, that ram shows up all over in Jewish history. Yaakov Avinu's, Adam's staff shows up again and again. Moshe's staff shows up again and again. That's a good question. What else do we have that shows up again and again? Miriam's well. King David collects 5 rocks to fight Goliath. He only uses 1. What happens with the other 4? They show up again in Jewish history. So you have different things that Chazal say they didn't disappear. They
like you use a rock and then it stops working. It's a rock.
Right. Good point. Right. Okay. Coming back to our parsha. So Yaakov libates the matzeva with oil. He names the place Beis El, House of God. And he takes a vow. If God gives me bread to eat, sometimes you have bread and you can't eat it. He asks for bread to eat and garments to wear. Yes?
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but that place that he anointed in called Bethel was called Bethel prior to this incident.
There are many opinions in Chazal as to what this place is. We're not exactly sure. So that could be right. Meaning there's a discussion. Where did he go to sleep? Was it the Temple Mount? Or where did he see the ladder? Was it Beit El? Was it Luz? What's going on? You know, you have many markers in the Pasuk, and it's not so clear what happened there. Different midrashim, different opinions in Chazal. Okay. So if our sages didn't know, I don't know. So Yaakov Avinu says, I will make this rock into a house of worship for Hashem. Chazal tell us a person shouldn't make vows. If a person makes a vow, most often it leads to sin. Tov asher lo tidor, King Solomon said. Better you not take a vow, mishetido velo teshalem, rather than taking a vow and not paying up. Yaakov will pay for this. He will lose Rachel over this vow, because he will come back in peace to Israel, and he will not go right away back to this place. And so, even though Shechem was going to rape a girl, it didn't have to be Yaakov's daughter. And even though Dinah did something improper which she deserved to be punished for, it didn't have to be a punishment that would hurt Yaakov so badly. But the reason Yaakov had to suffer to have his daughter raped was because he didn't fulfill his vow. And he didn't get the hint, and then his own wife died. And even though Rachel had her reasons for dying, as we will discuss, why did Rachel deserve to die, but why did Yaakov deserve to lose his wife? And so Chazal say, because he made this vow, and he wasn't quick enough to keep it. He said, if I get back in peace, I will make this a house of worship for Hashem. We will see in next week's parasha, he gets back in peace, and it takes him over 2 years to come back, or a year and a half, to come back and fulfill this vow. And as the time goes on, he keeps getting punished. So that's why the recommendation is don't make vows. You want to do something good, do it, but don't take a vow. Yaakov Avinu says, whatever you give me, what's bothering you? What about it? Thursday night. Yaakov Avinu says, Asera Asrenu Lach, tithe I shall tithe it. And so our sages learn that you give a tithe and you can give another tithe. Because Yaakov Avinu says twice he will tithe it. And that's why when a person's wealthy, he's allowed to give 20%. He's even supposed to give 20% of his wealth. Yaakov goes out. And here we have three shepherds. You have to understand that if the Torah bothers telling you how many shepherds and bothers recording the conversation, there are deep secrets going on in the story. It's not just, three shepherds, very nice, okay, great. Something going on here. At any rate, they tell him, we can't take that rock off without all the shepherds getting together. And this 72-year-old man single-handedly takes the rock off the well, or sages say, this is one indication we have of the great strength that the patriarchs had. Yes?
Anything mentioned about, it seems, again, somebody of Yaakov's stature, here he is fleeing, he's scared, I think he's basically penniless, right? I mean, what he had, they saw his son, they said, was going to kill him, right? To talk, so, and he says, if you do this for me, God, I'll give you 10%, maybe 20. I mean, you know, I owe you everything if you see me through this, and I will, I'll live my life as he did, in the way where he built up on Israel. But this idea of I'll do what's expected of me, maybe a little more, it just seems, it's kind of odd making a bargain like that. I mean, God's going to make him live because he has faith in him, and whether the fact that he's going to give his 10% or something, doesn't seem so heroic. I don't know, maybe I'm looking at it wrong.
But doesn't it go the other way around? God already promised him he'll get all of this?
Good point, you got the blessings. So now we say, maybe you could say, well, even though I was blessed with all this, why am I so scared? So it can go both ways, but yeah, it made a good point.
Saying he already had all this. He didn't have to volunteer anything. And he said,
he's so scared.
Does it say he was scared or does it say on the contrary? Vayisayakov raglav. With this he had might, he got up and went. So it seems to say that now he was encouraged. Vayisayakov raglav. Here it seems he was encouraged. Okay, so why does Yaakov show up penniless? So there's a difficult concept. I'm not sure exactly how to term it gently. There's a difficult concept. We'll call it don't be a moron. Okay? It's as gentle as I can do. Eliphaz shows up. You know, Grandpa Esav sends his son, grandson Eliphaz. He says, go bump Yaakov off. So Eliphaz catches up to Yaakov. And Yaakov says, you know, I taught you Torah. Eliphaz says, yeah, but you know, you taught me keep it out of aim. I got to honor my dad. Dad said to kill you. So you look at that and you say, okay. You know, sometimes you talk to someone and they define their logic for you, you know. And you hear the logic and you look at them and you say, okay, if that's your logic, I got to work with your logic, right? Now, first of all, that in its own right is a lesson because it's something that we sometimes don't know how to do. And if you know how to do it, you'll be victorious in many instances in life. I'll tell you a small story. There was Yankel the Meshuggah. Okay, you have this town, and Yankel's a little crazy. So Yankel sees a cat in the tree, and he decides he's going up after the cat. He climbs up the tree, and the cat jumps down. And then Yankel's up in the tree, and he doesn't want to come down. So his father comes out and says, Yankel, come down from there if you get hurt. Yankel says, no, not coming down from here. I'm up here. So his mother comes out and says, Yankel, come down from there. No, I'm staying up here. So his uncle comes out and says, Yankel, you got to get down. You don't want to get hurt, and it's getting late, and it's getting night, and it's going to be dark. You got to come down. And Yankel says, no, I'm up here. I'm not coming down. So you start having this whole cluster of people standing all around the tree, and begging him to come down, and he's defiant standing up there on the tree. Finally, his cousin Shmuley walks over and he says, guys, clear the way, clear the way. They all clear the way. He looks around, he sees a rusty knife on the floor. He picks up the knife and he says, Yankel, you want to stay up there? You can stay up there. But I'm going to take this rusty knife. And do you know what happens to a tree if you start cutting a tree with a knife like this? You're going to see right now what happens. And he takes the rusty knife and he starts moving it back and forth along the base of the tree. Yankel sees it. He says, don't, Shmuley, please don't. I'm coming down right now. He climbs quickly down and runs into the house. So they ask him, what'd you do? He said, look, you know it doesn't cut down the tree. I know it doesn't cut down the tree, but Yankel doesn't know it doesn't cut down the tree, right? If Yankel's insane, so we got to talk to Yankel the way you talk to Yankel. Now, this is true about so many things. It begins with your two-year-old. People try to talk intelligently to the two-year-old. Sometimes you just got to change the subject. Of course mommy loves you, but it's good for you to stay in Ghana. Of course we love you, but it's educational for you. And you're going to learn so much, and it's going to be fun, and eventually you have to learn to sever your ties. That's not what you say to the two-year-old. You sit down and you say, look at these gorgeous blocks, and look at what toys, and why don't you go and find me that wagon? And you get them distracted, and you do what you got to do. Grandma and Grandpa have to leave, but Grandma and Grandpa have to go home, but it's late. He's not understanding, so you have to talk his language, distraction or some other tool. It starts there, but it doesn't end there. Very often you deal with people, and they're dealing on their plane, and they don't read your plane. You have it very often as you're boarding a plane, or as you're dealing with the bureaucracy here in the country. I'll give you. I told you the story about our stroller.
Yep.
We call in the stroller. Had like four things to be fixed in a span of 6 months. So we call in and say, you know, guys, this seems like a lemon. Let's switch it. So they say no. Okay. So we say, but what am I? You know, you're arguing them, you're getting nowhere. So eventually, you put the problem back to them. Okay, using your logic, what am I supposed to do now for 2 weeks without a stroller? Ah, no problem. We'll give you a stroller. We'll give you a free stroller for the interim. Okay, fine, okay, so, you know, I but you got to work with their logic, because my logic says, you see it's a lemon, so give me something else. They say, no, I'm not going to give you something else. Ah, but, so let me share with you my problem. Now let's use your logic to solve my problem. And very often we are reluctant to do that. We're reluctant to do it with our spouses, and we stay stuck in life because we're not willing to go over to someone else's logic. And then we have situations where we have people who we will not succeed in communicating or working with them. Yaakov Avinu is faced with a man who says, "Keep it avim, of course I have to kill you." So what's Yaakov Avinu supposed to say? "Listen here, young man, let me explain to you. You don't murder in the name of Kibbut Avim." No, he doesn't understand that. So if he doesn't understand that, work according to his system. "Let me tell you how you could do Kibbut Avim." So Yaakov tells him, "If I don't have any money, life is about being able to affect the world. If you can't have impact on the world, that's not called life. So halachically, a poor man is also considered in certain respects dead. Come, take my money, and you could tell Dad you killed me. Effectively, you've killed me. You've made me inactive, inoperable." "Oh, great idea. Okay, fine, give me all the money, goodbye." "Okay, you're laughing, but you will see in life, you meet up with people who are no less ridiculous. And in their mind, what they're saying makes sense. You got to work with them in their system." And I could tell you stories on and on like this. Okay, I'll tell you one great story. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu flew out to the United States, and a couple came to meet him to get his blessing. They're about to get married, so he's being entertained by this Sephardi community, and the young man comes in with his dad, and the young lady comes in with her dad, and they sit down before him, and Rav Mordechai Eliyahu asked them, when did you get engaged, when are you getting married? And then he asked the young man, what community do you come from? And he tells him what type of Sephardi community he comes from. And he asks the young lady, "What community do you come from?" And she says, "I'm Catholic." So so now, what are you supposed to say? So Rav Mordechai Eliyahu is sitting there, and they've come to get his blessing as they're about to get married. So he looks at them, and he says, "Give me a minute." He closes his eyes. And then he looks at them and he says, I don't think this union will work. I think this is a bad idea for you guys to get married." So the girl gets up, looks at the guy and says, "You see, even the rabbi says, you're just not good enough for me." And walks out with her father. So the young man is devastated and he's sitting there and he says, "Rabbi, look, we know you're a man of God. Whatever you said, fine, we'll do it. But how did you know? You just met us. Just tell me, how'd you know?" So Rav Eliyahu said to him, he said, "Young man, do you think that when I closed my eyes here a minute ago, I was here? I wasn't here. I closed my eyes, my soul went up to heaven and asked, is it a fitting marriage or not? And they told me it's a bad idea. I wasn't telling you." So he said, when he said over the story, he said, "Now, if I would tell him, biblically, it's prohibited. Would he listen? No. But if I tell him, I asked in heaven and they said it's a bad idea, so it's true. In heaven they said it's a bad idea, but you got to talk to the guy the language that he's willing to hear." So in life, sometimes you can succeed if you're willing to talk the guy's language. You tell him, "Moses went up to heaven, brought down a Torah, and that's what it said. I don't know what you're talking about." You tell him, "I'm telling you in heaven, that's what they said. Okay, I'm willing to believe you." Now, this isn't simple. This is the wisdom of Solomon. The two women come in. He knows from their story who's the murderer and who isn't. But he has to talk their language. "Bring me a knife. I know I'm a 12-year-old king, but I say what I say goes." You have to understand, King Solomon took the throne. He fired everyone, replaced every officer in the kingdom. Okay, the treasurer, everyone was now fired and new people hired. So he's the boss, no questions. 12-year-old boss, okay, they bring the two prostitutes, bring a baby, and one claims, she slept on her baby and killed it, and then she stole mine. So technically, there are no witnesses. Goodbye, lady, you have no proof, goodbye. She's holding the live baby. And from her words, Shlomo could hear, and there's proof within the text, that she's the liar. The one who presented her case first, the one who was holding the dead baby, really killed her own baby by mistake. But he doesn't do that. He talks their language. And I could tell you more stories that way, but we got a whole parsha to finish. At the end of the day, if you try to win using your language, very often you don't. If you're willing to hear the other person, understand their language, work with their system, you can achieve a lot. And sometimes you can work with people who you ordinarily wouldn't be able to work with. And you will see it in life. You will talk to people, and you will walk away and say, I don't know what form of logic they're using, but we're not on the same page. But that doesn't mean you can't work. You can work using their logic. Yeah?
I'd say the best way to learn how to do that is work in a hospitality where people come to you with complaints. You deal with that all the time, and it's very true. Like, there's the main school of thought that most places will say, like, can we give you a discount? And that's how they want to solve the problem. And then there's the school of thought that says, all right, this happened. How can we move forward? And you get them involved in creating a solution, and it shows you a different way of thinking.
Yafem. So Yaakov comes into Haran penniless, but he saved his life.
But why couldn't he just kill the guy? He's trying to kill him. The Esav's grandson, Eliphaz, is trying to kill Yaakov. Yaakov has every right to defend himself.
Correct.
Why didn't he use that option?
I'm not sure. I don't know of a source that addresses it directly. But if I had to guess, the simplest answer might be that Eliphaz caught up to him and he had his arrow pointed at him. Like, it was game over. You know, you could win when it's hand-to-hand combat, but when Eliphaz comes out of the brush and he's facing him with the bow and arrow pulled, so, you know, he had to talk his way out of it. Coming back to our parsha, so Yaakov removes the stone, he gives Rachel's sheep to drink, and he weeps. He recognizes that they are meant to be married, but that it's not going to end well. So they have a conversation. Yaakov tells Rachel, do we want to build a life together? And after having a long date, Rachel is interested. Rachel says, you know, I've heard a lot about you, but my dad's a con artist. Yaakov says, I know how to con people too. Rachel says, really? I thought part of being pious is that you don't con people. Yaakov says, no. You got to know how to deal with con artists, so you got to know how to deal with that too. So she says, fine, what's your plan? So he says, I'm going to tell him the deal is I marry you. She says, yeah, but there are many me. He'll take a Rachel from the street. He says, yeah, I'll tell him I'm marrying Rachel, your daughter. She says, fine, he has other daughters. He'll give you another girl. He'll say, that's my daughter. He'll change her name to Rachel, you know, the day before the wedding. He'll go and officially change her name to Rachel. He'll give her to you. He says, no, I'll say your small daughter, Rachel. So she says, you're the short one, you're the small daughter, you're the young one, you're the daughter, Rachel, fine. Rachel says, okay. Yaakov says, fine, but we're going to do another thing. I'll tell you, there are three mitzvahs that a woman's responsible for in the Jewish home. Nida, challah, hadlakas aner, right? Lighting the candles, family purity, and taking off the challah. So under the chuppah, I'm going to ask you, what's your responsibility in the marriage? And you're going to answer me those three, and that's our sign, just in case he gets someone else in there. Well, you'll have the answer. We'll catch it. Okay. Yaakov is working for 7 years, and he's very excited, and he comes to Lavan, and he says, okay, the time has come. So Lavan gathers everyone, he makes this big party, and he gives Yaakov a lot of booze to drink, and he puts out the lights, and the people start singing, Hileah, Hileah, Hileah. And Yaakov doesn't get the hint. That's why there's a Sephardi custom till today. They sing Hileah, Hileah, Hileah. Leah and Rachel were twins, and the lights are out, and the time is set for Rachel to walk down the aisle, and Lavan walks into the room and says, Rachel, you're not going. Give Leah the wedding gown. And Rachel is sitting there in stunned silence, and she doesn't see a way out. So Leah has been spending her whole life praying that she doesn't want to end up in Esav's lot. And now her prayers were answered. In heaven, they want this to happen. Leah slowly puts on the wedding gown, and Rachel is thinking fast. She's saying, wait a second. She's going to go down that aisle. She's going to get to the chuppah. She's going to get to the chuppah. Yaakov's going to ask her for the signs. She's not going to know the signs, and Yaakov's going to say, stop. This is a farce. And then what's going to happen? So my father, well, he deserves it, but Leah doesn't deserve it. She didn't do anything. I can't let that happen. And at that moment, Rachel makes a move to give up on life. She turns to Leah and says, Leah, I got to tell you something. You're going to get down there under the chuppah. Yaakov's going to ask you a question. Here's the answer. And she gives away the sign. So she comes down there under the chuppah, and let's fast forward to the next morning. Word gets out what's happened. And Esav hears about it in Israel, and he bursts out laughing, and he says, great, I heard the younger one was more beautiful. And he lets it be known that he's interested in Rachel. Look, there were twins, one for me, one for him. He took Leah, I get Rachel. And word gets back to Rachel that Esav is now waiting for her. So Rachel has not only given up on her role in Jewish history, she is now living for the rest of her life with the threat, or at least for most of her life now, she will live with the threat that Esav thinks he's entitled to Rachel now. So Leah, who has spent her whole life weeping that she might end up being Esav's wife, her prayers were answered. Whereas Rachel, who was always happy-go-lucky because she thought her future was secure, now Rachel's in danger. So the next morning, Yaakov turns, he sees it's Leah. He says, huh? So Rachel told you the signs. Wow, she's so pious. And you? What type of human being are you? All night long, I'm calling you Rachel, and you're answering me. So Leah says, you know, most people have students. The way it works in life is you do something, you teach people how to behave. So I think that when your father called you Esav, you also answered. So I thought I was supposed to learn from you that when it comes to spirituality, if you want to accomplish, then it's permissible to answer to someone else's name, because if it's for the right purposes, then I thought it was okay. So Leah wins the fight, but loses her husband's heart. Sometimes by winning a fight, you lost a lot. So Yaakov is super impressed with Rachel, but not so impressed with Leah. But in heaven, they side with Leah. Yeah?
Doesn't he come? He says he loves Leah too later.
Right,
so
right.
Yeah.
So technically, Leah and Rachel were both infertile. They couldn't have kids. But we know the rest of the story. He comes and he demands of Lavan. Lavan says, you'll work another 7 years. He takes Lavan to court. Lavan says, you said the little one. You didn't say the younger one. Rachel's the taller one. So I gave you the little one. I did change her name to Rachel, you know. She is my daughter, and she is the little one. You know, she's not the younger one. And anyways, that's not the custom over here. And he goes to court, and Yaakov sees he can't win. So that's part of the reason that Lavan made this party with everyone invited, and everyone knows what's going on. They're all hinting to him, he Leah, and the next morning Yaakov realizes, and Lavan tells him, look, you're in my part of the world, and everyone here knows the laws, and I worked by the book, and you have a problem, so now work.
Unbelievable, they made a sign. I mean, you know, who does those things? The thought that they might very well be tricked.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's definitely, I guess, there.
Yeah. So Yaakov's already 79 years old. And he's got work to do. You know, he's got to build a family. And God makes a miracle, and Leah becomes pregnant from the first night. That's unusual. A woman usually doesn't become pregnant from the first night. It's very hard for the seed to get in when a woman's a virgin. But at any rate, Leah becomes pregnant, and the first son is named Reuven. And we are out of time. You guys wanted a Jewish home class, so Thursday night business.